ratification of the Constitution, military troops were rarely, if ever, used for routine law enforcement. But that would soon change. On April 8, 1851, Charles Loring stood up in a Boston courtroom to deliver his closing argument. He'd represented his client for only a few days, but the man's freedom hung in the balance. Outside the courtroom, federal marshals, militia, and Boston constables and watchmen stood guard. Iron chains blocked all entrances to the building. 4 days earlier, Thomas Sims, a 17-year-old escaped slave, had been arrested in the Free State of Massachusetts. Sims had escaped the Savannah plantation of John Potter, one of the city's wealthiest farmers. Sims then stowed away on a freight ship, which brought him to Boston. Sims had been arrested under the Fugitive Slave Act, passed the year before as part of the Compromise of 1850, a package of bills aimed at ameliorating the growing tensions between free and slave states. An earlier Fugitive Slave Act, passed in 1793, already prohibited citizens from aiding the escape of slaves and mandated their return to their masters. But as slavery fell out of favor in the North, many cities and towns became places of refuge for freed slaves. State legislatures in the North began passing laws that made it easier for escaped slaves to win their freedom. The 1850 law was passed to plug the holes that had subsequently been poked in the law passed a half century earlier. Even for its time, it was an outrageous piece of legislation. Any black person in a free state could be claimed as an escaped slave on little more than the word of a southerner claiming to own him. The accused would then be arrested and given a hearing, not a jury trial, in front of an appointed federal commissioner, not a judge. Denied habeas corpus, the alleged slave was neither permitted to testify on his own behalf nor allowed to personally challenge the word of the man who claimed him as his property. The commissioner's decision could not be appealed. Anyone aiding a slave's escape, even by merely offering him food or water, was guilty of a federal offense, punishable by a $1,000 fine and 6 months in prison. Not only were federal marshals paid bounties for capturing escaped slaves, they could be fined $1,000 if they refused to arrest a black person whom any white person claimed was a slave. As if all that weren't enough, the appointed commissioners who decided the fates of the accused were paid $10 if they ruled in favor of the slave owner, but just $5 if they ruled in favor of the alleged slave. The law was so skewed toward slave owners that even blacks who had been free all their lives were at risk of being consigned to slavery by false accusations. The Sims case attracted national attention among opponents of slavery. When Sims was ordered back to the plantation, prominent abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, Ralph Waldo Emerson, William Lloyd Garrison, and Henry David Thoreau wrote enraged polemics condemning the farcical proceedings. But most of Boston was complacent. The prospect of a civil war was daunting. For the time being, many in the North were willing to tolerate slave catching as the price for avoiding bloodshed, at least bloodshed by people other than slaves. 3 years later, the mood had changed, and Boston was again the site of a fugitive slave hearing. 19-year-old Anthony Burns had escaped to Boston from an estate in Richmond, Virginia. He was working for a clothier when he was apprehended on May 24, 1854, by slave catcher Asa O. Butman, who arrested him under the pretext of a jewelry store robbery. On the morning of Burns's hearing, armed abolitionists, calling themselves the Vigilance Committee, forced their way into the courtroom with a battering ram. In the ensuing melee, a federal marshal was killed. The rescue was unsuccessful, and the rescuers were arrested, but the event captured Boston's attention and the country's. When Burns's hearing resumed the next day, thousands of people came out to protest. Boston Mayor J.V.C. Smith called up two companies of the Massachusetts militia to keep order for the remainder of the hearing. Finding those forces inadequate, he then contacted President Franklin Pierce directly to request that 2 U.S. Army battalions and 50 Marines be sent to Boston. During his 1852 campaign, Pierce had vowed more robust enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act. So when Smith asked for troops, Pierce consented. He also put hundreds more troops on standby, just in case Smith needed them. By the end of the week, the hearing still wasn't over. Because Burns would have to be kept in Boston over the weekend, the troops had to stay there too. The protests grew, as did tensions between the troops and the protesters. On June 2, 1854, slave commissioner Edward G. Loring, a double cousin of the man who had defended Thomas Sims, ordered Anthony Burns returned to Virginia. Some 50,000 Bostonians poured into the streets and took to rooftops in protest. Some flew American flags upside down, and others shouted, "Kidnappers!" at the police and soldiers. One group hoisted a coffin under a banner that read, "The Funeral of Liberty." The city was angry, as much at the law as at the amount of force their own state officials had brought to bear to enforce it. The moment Loring issued his decision, Boston went into lockdown. The troops fired cannons in the air as a warning to the protesters. The mayor declared martial law, probably illegally. Over the next several hours, U.S. soldiers and state militiamen cleared the streets of Boston. On several occasions, the militiamen fired into the crowd. When the troops mistook a crowd surge for an assault, they charged the protesters with bayonets. There were numerous injuries, a few of them serious, but somewhat miraculously, there were no fatalities. Once the streets were cleared, another group of troops marched the prisoner from the courthouse to the steamship waiting for him at the docks. From Boston Harbor, the site of the Boston Tea Party, the ship and the federal troops aboard it took Anthony Burns back to Virginia, from a city nicknamed the Cradle of Liberty to the shackles awaiting him in Richmond. It hadn't yet been 100 years since the Boston Massacre, in which British soldiers fired first into the air, then directly into a mob of angry protesters, effectively sparking the American Revolution. Yet on the morning of June 2, 1854, it was U.S. soldiers who lined Boston's streets, who fired shots from a cannon positioned in the town square as a warning to fellow Americans, and who used the threat of military force to silence the speech of American citizens. The reason for the protests, that a man who had escaped the yoke and found refuge in the arms of a free state was being sent back into bondage, only compounded the poignancy of the scene. The heavy-handed response and the arresting imagery of federal troops imposing martial law on an American city was bad enough, but the Anthony Burns affair also brought about a new and significant breach of the symbolic Third Amendment. Like Franklin Pierce, who had appointed him, U.S. Attorney General Caleb Cushing was a doughface, a northerner with southern sympathies. He had been looking for an occasion to strengthen enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act, as his boss had promised in the campaign. In response to the vigilantism and public backlash in Boston, he issued what became known as the Cushing Doctrine. The policy allowed U.S. Marshals to call up the military to help them enforce federal law without explicit authorization from either the President or the Congress. Prior to the Cushing Doctrine, when a U.S. Marshal needed a posse, he typically drew it from men in his jurisdiction. If he needed backing from the military, he had to get authorization from the President. The difficulty of obtaining that authorization made such requests rare. The Cushing Doctrine made it easier. Calling on federal troops to use force against American citizens had been reserved for insurrection or rebellion. But now there was a new criterion. A single marshal could call up troops merely if he felt that people were preventing him from performing his duties. The opinion would be used to hunt down fugitive slaves in northern states where the fugitive slave law was unpopular, to put down John Brown's anti-slavery revolt at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, and to enforce federal law on the relatively lawless western frontier. A major barrier had come down. The federal military could now be routinely used to enforce federal law. And it happened not by way of a constitutional amendment, or a vote from an elected Congress, or even a Supreme Court decision, but after an opinion issued by a U.S. Attorney General. The next challenge to the symbolic Third Amendment came after the Civil War, during Reconstruction. The federal government stationed U.S. troops throughout the southern states to protect ex-slaves from retribution and to enforce the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments and the Reconstruction Acts. By most any definition, the troops were an occupying force, performing or closely overseeing nearly all government functions in the former Confederacy. The mass deployment of troops in the South was made possible by a series of laws called the Force Acts. The first law, passed by Congress in 1870, made it a federal crime to use threats, force, intimidation, or bribery to keep someone from voting based on race or prior status as a slave. It was basically the enforcement mechanism for the 13th Amendment. The second law, passed in 1871, allowed for federal oversight of elections if two or more citizens in any town of more than 20,000 people requested it. The third law, also passed in 1871, is sometimes called the Ku Klux Klan Act. It gave the federal government sweeping authorization to use the military against any groups suspected of conspiring against federal law. The law also made the terror and intimidation tactics used by white supremacist groups a federal offense. It authorized the president to suspend habeas corpus if, in his judgment, other efforts to suppress race-related terror and violence weren't working. As long as the troops were in place, Reconstruction worked. The federal presence prevented state and local officials in the former Confederate states from denying blacks the right to vote, barring them from holding public office, or consigning ex-slaves to indentured servitude. The troops also helped prevent mob violence and lynching, although both still happened. But the disputed presidential election of 1876 put an end to all of that. No candidate won a majority of electoral votes, so the election was decided by a backroom deal between Republican and Democratic leaders. Republican Rutherford B. Hayes emerged as the president-elect in a deal that required him to pull federal troops out of the South, effectively ending Reconstruction. The Compromise of 1877 brought in a new era of mob violence, systematic discrimination, segregation, and general second-class status for blacks that endured for the next 80 years, essentially until the Civil Rights Movement started accumulating victories in the mid-20th century. A little over a year after Hayes took office, Kentucky Representative J. Proctor Knott introduced an amendment to an Army Appropriations Bill to bar the enlistment of federal troops for law enforcement purposes without authorization from Congress or the President. Knott's aim was modest. He simply wanted to repeal the Cushing Doctrine. The amendment to the law, which became known as the Posse Comitatus Act, reads, "From and after the passage of this act, it shall not be lawful to employ any part of the Army of the United States as a posse comitatus, or otherwise, for the purpose of executing the laws, except in such cases, under such circumstances, as such employment of said force may be expressly authorized by the Constitution or by Act of Congress." The law's main effect was exactly what Knott intended. It nullified the Cushing Doctrine. U.S. Marshals could no longer call up U.S. troops to help them enforce federal law unless they obtained authorization from the president. Some historians and scholars have claimed that the Posse Comitatus Act was fallout from the Compromise of 1877, and that the true aim of its supporters was to repeal Reconstruction. The suggestion is that the law is tainted by racism and sympathy for the Confederacy. There's some truth to that. The law certainly made it more difficult to enforce Reconstruction. But Reconstruction was already on the way out. It had lost support in the North. Hayes, a Republican, had even promised to end it during his campaign. And the law actually ended a policy that had been created to catch fugitive slaves. It's an unfortunate commentary on the plight of freed blacks at the time that they could be made worse off by a new policy, then made worse off still by its repeal. Reconstruction was a necessary policy, and it was probably necessary to use troops to enforce it. But it was a once-in-American-history sort of crisis. The deployments were authorized by acts of Congress. The 14th Amendment required the federal government to protect the rights of black Americans in the South, and it seems clear that a few hundred federal marshals weren't sufficient for the job. Reconstruction set a new bar for military involvement in domestic affairs, but there's been nothing like it since. After federal troops were pulled out of the South, the domestic deployment of U.S. troops mostly reverted back to limited situations, like large-scale riots and violent insurrections. The term posse comitatus traditionally referred to the population of able-bodied men from which a posse could be drawn. Today, both the term and the law have come to represent much more than the text in Knott's amendment indicates. The law itself is now commonly misunderstood to bar the president or Congress from using the military to enforce federal or state law. That isn't quite correct. The law only prevents domestic law enforcement officials from using the military to enforce the law without authority from the president or Congress. It puts no restrictions on the Congress or the president. But more broadly, the term posse comitatus has become a signal for the principles behind the symbolic Third Amendment. It's often used today to indicate our traditional aversion to putting soldiers in the streets. Regardless of the origins of the term, the sentiment behind it has persisted, often in spite of the best efforts of elected officials. More comforting, one institution that has held the principle in especially high regard is the military itself, although here too there have been a few exceptions. In the 19th century, as America was sorting out when and how and under what conditions the military could be deployed domestically, the country was also growing. By the 1830s, U.S. cities were swelling and becoming more diverse. Predatory crime was increasingly a problem. The country needed new ideas and new institutions for maintaining day-to-day order, institutions that could be scaled to accommodate growing urbanization. Once again, the country would look to England for inspiration. Chapter 3. A Quick History of Cops in America. Democratic law tends more and more to be grounded upon the maxim that every citizen is by nature a traitor, a libertine, and a scoundrel. In order to dissuade him from his evil doing, the police power is extended until it surpasses anything ever heard of in the Oriental monarchies of antiquity. H. L. Mencken, Notes on Democracy. Colonial American towns were usually filled with people who came from the same place, worshipped at the same altar, and shared the same sense of right and wrong. Historian and criminologist Sam Walker writes, "Crime and sin were synonymous. An offense against God was an offense against society, and vice versa. Predatory crimes like murder, rape, and robbery were almost non-existent. Far more common were punishments for crimes like blasphemy, adultery, or drunkenness." Not surprisingly, law and policing in pre-revolutionary America were modeled fairly closely on the English example. Given the rugged conditions of frontier living and the lack of civic structures, trial and punishment were relatively rare. Mores and shared values were generally sufficient, and when they weren't, shunning and other forms of informal justice usually worked to keep civic order. Not all colonial communities were the same, and laws varied from place to place depending on the prevailing religion and tradition. But there was little need for state agents to enforce the law. Communities tended to handle transgressors on their own. There were crown-appointed sheriffs and constables, but again, they largely focused on administrative matters. As the country grew, three distinctive policing traditions began to emerge, coinciding with three regions: the Northeast, the South, and the Western frontier. In the Northeast, as the cities grew larger and more diverse in the early 18th century, their residents encountered more crime. Throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, early American cities first installed night watch patrols, first voluntary and then paid. The night watches were fairly successful at rounding up drunks and preventing petty infractions. But the low-paying positions would prove inadequate when cities began to experience riots, mobs, and more serious crimes. The southern colonies were more agrarian, less compact, and more homogeneous than the colonies of the Northeast. The primary threat to public safety in the South, at least in the minds of whites, was the possibility of slave revolts. As a result, the first real organized policing systems in America arguably began in the South with slave patrols. The patrols were armed and uniformed, and typically had broad powers to arrest, search, and detain slaves. The slave patrol's main responsibilities were to guard against rebellions and to look for escaped slaves. They had the power to enter slave quarters at will, whether or not they had permission from the slave's owner. They could even enforce some laws against plantation owners, such as laws prohibiting the education of slaves. By the middle of the 18th century, every southern colony had passed laws formalizing slave patrols. It became the primary policing system in the South. In many jurisdictions, most notably Charleston, South Carolina, slave patrols would eventually morph into the official police force. On the western frontier, early policing was more piecemeal. Northern settlers tended to congregate together and set up systems in the northern tradition, while pioneers from the South followed the southern tradition. But the expanse of the frontier didn't always accommodate either system. Often there was just too much ground to cover, and the territory was too sparsely populated. That gap was often filled by vigilantes and private police for hire. The vigilante groups came together in response to some threat to public order, then dissolved once the threat had subsided. As the name implies, they tended to operate outside the formal legal system, and were naturally more prone to pop up where the legal system either didn't exist or was too weak to maintain order. In some cases, vigilante groups were better than no justice at all. In other cases, they were quite a bit worse. The first modern police force, as we know it today, was created in 1829 in London by Sir Robert Peel. He and his father had been pushing the idea for decades, but British concerns over the nation's civil liberties tradition had repeatedly killed the idea. Concerned about the worsening conditions in the city, Parliament finally gave its approval in 1829, but only after Peel put in place assurances and checks to retain some local control over the force and ensure that police officers' responsibilities were limited to fighting crime and protecting individual rights. His task was to convince the city that a police force would not be an army enforcing the will of a centralized power. The British police force began with 3,000 officers. They wore uniforms to make themselves recognizable, but Peel made the uniforms blue to distinguish them from the red worn by the British military. Peel was sensitive to concerns about standing armies, but he also believed that a successful police force would need at least some of the structure and discipline of a military influence. Peel appointed a retired colonel as one of his two first supervising justices. Thus, the inaugural police force took on a military-like, top-down administrative structure, and even borrowed some military titles. It's a tradition that continues in most police departments in the United States today. Peel and his justices set out a strict code of conduct. Officers were to avoid confrontation when at all possible. They were to be civil and polite when interacting with citizens. Most of all, Peel hammered home the principle that his police force worked for the people of London, not against them. Nevertheless, it took a while for the public to warm to the idea. Across the Atlantic, in rapidly urbanizing America, larger cities began to adopt the British model, albeit with some Americanized adjustments. The first modern-style police department in the United States was established in New York in 1845. Boston and Philadelphia soon followed. New York began its experiment with 800 policemen. Fearing that the London force was already too much like an army, the New York cops began their patrols unarmed and without uniforms. Early American police departments were also much more democratic than the system in London. Peel and his top aides hand-picked the officers to work in London. In the United States, early police officers were nominated by ward leaders and political bosses, then appointed by the mayor. Cops were required to live in the wards they patrolled. All of this tended to make early police departments more like service agencies than law enforcement bodies. Since ward leaders were elected, they found they could pressure local commanders to prioritize police duties in ways that would help get them reelected. In some neighborhoods, police officers ran soup kitchens and homeless people were given shelter in police stations to sleep. This democratic style of policing also gave police, or more accurately, their commanders, discretion to enforce laws in ways that reflected the priorities of the communities they patrolled. Alcohol laws, for example, might be strictly enforced in one part of a city, but rarely, if ever, enforced in another. In some ways, this wasn't all that dissimilar to the way laws had been enforced before police departments existed, when transgressions within a community were handled by its members. But there were some clear drawbacks. The job of police officer had quickly become a patronage position. The only qualification for becoming a cop was a political connection. Mass firings were common when power changed hands. The ethnicity of a ward's police force tended to be exclusively that of the majority of the ward's population. This could be problematic for, say, an Italian caught in a majority Irish neighborhood. Training was non-existent, beatings were common, and, perhaps most importantly, the system had little effect on crime, neither preventing it nor helping to bring criminals to justice. Ironically, the more centralized, less democratic London model proved to be more protective of individual rights than early American police departments. Centralization allowed Peel to set high, consistent hiring standards based on merit. Because he was so aware of the English public's fears about violations of their civil liberties, Peel knew that the survival of his police department was probably contingent on his ability to alleviate those fears. And so by the end of the 19th century, London's Bobbies, the nickname derived from Peel's name, had managed to win over the public within a couple of decades, while the reputation of the American police officer had hit bottom. With no training or standards, and with jobs based on patronage more than merit, the police in America were best known for corruption, brutality, and incompetence. Wealthy citizens looked instead to private organizations like the Pinkertons when they needed reliable security or knew of a crime they wanted solved. By the early 20th century, police reform had become a cause of the progressive movement, whose adherents saw corrupt cops as just another consequence of cities being run by political machines. There were two competing voices for reform. Progressive academics and elites wanted not only to rid police departments of patronage and corruption, but to mandate a more paternalistic role for police. They wanted cops to enforce good habits and morals among the urban poor, especially immigrants. The other voice for reform came from administrators within the law enforcement community. They too wanted to free police departments from the political machines, but they focused less on ideology and more on fighting crime. They wanted to give more freedom and autonomy to police chiefs, who were often held responsible for the actions of their officers, but had very little power to actually change their behavior. In the end, the administrators won the long-term debate by embracing the concept of professionalism. Through the adoption of best practices, they successfully transformed the job of police officer from a perk of patronage to a formal profession with its own standards, specialized knowledge, and higher personnel standards and entry requirements. To be a police officer was no longer just a job, it was a career. The first 30 or so years of the 20th century saw the formation of professional societies, like the Police Chiefs Union, the sharing of knowledge and police sciences like fingerprinting, and the creation of specialized squads to tackle specific problems like alcohol, prostitution, and gambling. The champion of the professionalism movement was August Vollmer, who served as chief of police in Berkeley, California, from 1905 to 1932. Vollmer pioneered the use of police radios, squad cars, bicycles, lie detector tests, and crime labs. As Walker writes, "The professionalism movement created the modern police organization, a centralized, authoritarian bureaucracy focusing on crime control." But the morals-oriented progressives also had some victories, at least in the short term. They succeeded in passing anti-obscenity laws, and in some cities, most notably New York, they were able to put shutting down brothels, adult bookstores, and other sex-related businesses high on the list of police priorities. Their biggest victory was, of course, the 18th Amendment, which banned the production, sale, and importation of alcohol. The amendment was enforced by the Volstead Act, passed in 1919. The prohibition of alcohol has some clear parallels with the modern drug war. Homicides spiked during prohibition, as did public corruption. The federal government had created a lucrative new black market. In legal markets, businesses compete by providing a better product, a less expensive product, or better customer service. In black markets, they compete by warring over turf. Disputes are settled with guns, not in courtrooms. As the bootleggers obtained bigger guns to war with one another, law enforcement agencies felt that they needed bigger guns to go after the criminals. In larger cities, the ensuing arms race produced heavily armed police forces. Like today's drug prohibition, the Volstead Act was a failure. It almost certainly reduced the amount of alcohol the country consumed, but it came nowhere near stamping out booze entirely. The true believers responded by calling for tougher crackdowns and less coddling of bootleggers and drinkers. In his book, The Spirits of America, journalist Eric Burns writes that some politicians and civic leaders suggested sending drunks and booze distributors to Siberia or the South Pole. Burns notes that David Blair, the Federal Commissioner of Internal Revenue at the time, recommended that all American bootleggers be lined up in front of a firing squad and shot to death. Foreshadowing the cries the country would hear from drug warriors 60 years later, Henry Ford wanted the military to enforce the laws against illicit substances. Anti-alcohol activist Clarence True Wilson demanded that the Harding administration call up the Marines, arm them to the teeth, and send them to the speakeasies, give the people inside a few minutes to depart, and if they chose not to, open fire anyhow. But as hard as the temperance activists tried, they couldn't demonize and dehumanize drinkers the way drug warriors have since succeeded in denigrating drug offenders. One likely reason was that the Volstead Act didn't criminalize the possession or consumption of alcohol, only its production and sale. So the feds could raid speakeasies, but they couldn't raid a home based on a tip that someone had a cupboard full of gin, unless they suspected there was a distillery inside. Since simply ingesting alcohol was not a criminal act, it was more difficult for prohibition's supporters to cast drinkers as villains. The country was also more federalist in the 1920s. Even after the 18th Amendment passed, some states, cities, and counties simply refused to enforce it. After the repeal of prohibition in 1933, the professionalism model returned to police departments. Although some of the aims of professionalism may have been noble, the story of early American policing is one of overcorrection. While the professionalism reformers were able to end the patronage system, in some cities they managed to insulate police departments from politics altogether, making it difficult for mayors and city councils to hold police officials accountable. At the level of individual cops, the use of squad cars and radios clearly brought a lot of benefits, but could also isolate police officers from the residents of the communities they patrolled. Cops out walking beats could chat with citizens, form relationships, and become a part of the community. Squad cars gave cops a faceless and intimidating presence. They tended not to get out of them, except in the event of problems or confrontations. Police and citizens interacted only when police were ticketing or questioning someone, or when a citizen was reporting a crime. In poorer communities, that could bring about an increasingly antagonistic relationship between cops and the citizens on their beats. Perhaps no police chief better illustrated that double-edged sword of professionalism than William Parker in Los Angeles. Parker took over the LAPD in 1950 and imposed a rigid, hierarchical, militaristic bureaucracy. He took on corruption in the department, successfully, and stressed efficiency and crime fighting above all else. Parker had also worked in public relations for the military for a time, and he used that experience to sell his ideas about policing to the public. He helped create the show Dragnet, a virtual commercial for Parker-style police management, or at least an idealized form of it. But Parker also loathed community policing, the idea that cops should have a stake in the communities they served. He preferred to have a wall between cop and community. That sentiment probably stemmed from the goal of ridding the department of the sort of localized interests that existed in the patronage era. But completely walling off cops from their communities presented its own problems, making cops indifferent to the areas they patrolled, instilling in them the notion that they were all that stood between order and anarchy. All of this could make police view the citizens in their districts as, at best, the other, and at worst, the enemy. Consequently, while Parker's management rid the LAPD of political patronage and corruption, and instilled some needed structure and standards, he seemed oblivious to growing animosity toward police in the city's black and Latino populations. Parker's efforts at instilling professionalism provide a good segue into the age of militarization for a couple of reasons. For one, as we'll see, when the racial tension in L.A. finally blew up in the form of the Watts riots, it went a long way towards scaring middle America about crime, to the point where they were willing to embrace an all-out war on crime and drugs to clean up the cities. But Parker also had a much more direct impact on militarization. Shortly after taking office, the chief made a young LAPD cop barely a year into the job his personal chauffeur, and eventually his protege. That set the young cop's career on a fast track. By the time of the Watts riots in 1965, Parker's young protege would take command of the city police department's response. The experience would scar him. The protege would eventually become LA's police chief himself. And in large part because of his experience in Watts, he did more to bring about today's militarized American police force than any other single person. His name was Darryl Gates. There are two forms of police militarization, direct and indirect. Direct militarization is the use of the standing military for domestic policing. Indirect militarization happens when police agencies and police officers take on more and more characteristics of an army. Most of this book will focus on the latter form of police militarization, which began in the United States in the late 1960s, then accelerated in the 1980s. But the two forms of militarization are related, and they have become increasingly intertwined over the last 30 years. So it's worth looking briefly at direct militarization in the 20th century as well. As discussed in the previous chapter, direct militarization has a longer history in the United States, but has been more limited in scope. One reason may be that deploying military forces domestically usually requires a formal declaration by the president, which means such deployments have been limited to self-contained events. By the middle of the 20th century, federal troops had been deployed in response to dozens of domestic disturbances, but the incidents were highly visible, and once the crisis abated, the troops left the scene. One of the more significant policies to move the country toward direct militarization was the Militia Act of 1903, sometimes called the National Guard Act. The Anti-Federalists, remember, advocated that the country rely on state militias for national defense. That didn't work out, but the militias stayed around and were often called up by state governors to dispel less threatening uprisings. But the militias were also sometimes called into war. In fact, the 1903 law was a response to widespread sentiment that the militias had performed poorly during the Spanish-American War. The new law took what remained of the state militias and converted them into what is today the National Guard. It also established an office in the Pentagon to oversee the Guard and appropriated funds to run the office and train Guard troops. Guard units would still report to their respective states and could still be called up by their governors when needed. But if called up by the president and federalized, they wouldn't be noticeably different from the military. One legacy of the National Guard Act was to make some state governors more likely to request military help from the president, and thus more reliant on the use of the military to quell disruptions. Military leaders weren't keen on this trend. They knew from history that sending soldiers to dispel citizens was usually a bad idea, and sowed ill will toward the army among the public. The ensuing confrontations between the military and labor protesters and strikers, anti-war activists, and other demonstrators certainly had that effect. Worse, they also sowed a certain contempt for protesters among some in the military. That sentiment, along with public anxiety about World War I and the Red Scare fears of communists and anarchists that followed, opened up a brief period in American history when military leaders seemed more willing to intervene in domestic life than ever before. The most infamous incident came in 1932. In June of that year, 40,000 World War I veterans and their supporters descended on Washington, D.C., to demand the bonus payment they had been promised for their service. They set up camps on the Anacostia Flats, a marshy area across the river from the U.S. Capitol, and named their makeshift city Hooverville to mock the president. As the bonus march began on July 28, 1932, there was an altercation in which police shot and killed two marching veterans. President Hoover responded by sending in the U.S. Army. Two regiments and six tanks moved into the nation's capital under the leadership of General Douglas MacArthur and Major George S. Patton. Major Dwight Eisenhower went along as an aide to MacArthur. The protesters initially cheered the military, thinking the troops were there to support them. Those cheers quickly turned to screams when the troops charged the protesters with guns and tear gas. When the protesters retreated back to Hooverville, Hoover ordered MacArthur to stand down. MacArthur defied the order and went after the protesters, razing the Hooverville shacks and chasing veterans, their families, and their supporters out of the makeshift town at the points of bayonets. The sight of veterans being lied to and then bloodied by the same U.S. Army in which they had served didn't sit well with the public. Angry condemnations rang out from newspapers, civil rights organizations, and veterans across the country. The crackdown doomed Hoover's already dim prospects for re-election and turned what had been an ambivalent public firmly in support of the veterans. Later that year, Patton wrote a remarkable paper recounting the lessons he had learned from the bonus march. Titled Federal Troops in Domestic Disturbances, it revealed a startling contempt for free expression and for civilians in general. The paper first assesses periods of unrest throughout history. Patton ridicules nations and empires that hesitated to use violence against citizen uprisings and praises those that did. When the foolish and genial Louis XVI lost his head and the Seine ran crimson to the sea, the fault lay not with the people but with the soldiers, Patton writes. Yet less than 10 years later, Napoleon, with a whiff of grapeshot, destroyed the mob and saved, only to usurp, the directorate. Patton attributes the success of the Bolshevik Revolution to the hesitating and weak character of the Russian officers, which prevented them from properly slaughtering the communists while they were merely protesters. Most alarming are Patton's own suggestions and recommendations on how the military should handle domestic riots and uprisings. He calls the writ of habeas corpus an item that rises to plague us, and recommends shooting captured rioters instead of turning them over to police to bring before some misguided judge who might release the rebellious citizen on a legal technicality. On establishing geographic bearings while breaking up a protest, Patton advises, it may be desirable to fly over the city to become oriented. If fired upon while in the air, reply at once with small bombs and machine gun fire. Using all caps for emphasis, he later writes, when guarding buildings, mark a dead line and announce clearly that those who cross it will be killed. Be sure to kill the first one who tries to cross it and to leave him there to encourage the others. Elsewhere, he writes, if it is necessary to use machine guns, aim at their feet. If you must fire, do a good job. A few casualties become martyrs. A large number becomes an object lesson. Patton and MacArthur rose through the ranks during the first Red Scare of 1919 to 1921, when the entire country crouched in a panicked fear of radicalism. This was the era of Woodrow Wilson's Sedition Act, the 1919 anarchist bombings, and the responding raids, arrests, and deportations of thousands by Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer. Every violent labor clash heightened fears that America was on the brink of Bolshevism. Like a number of U.S. political and civic leaders, many military leaders had soured on the notion of affording civil liberties to groups they believed were determined to overthrow the government. At a news conference after the Bonus March fiasco, for example, MacArthur showed no regret. He called the protesters a mob that was animated by the essence of revolution. He said their aim was to take over the government and that a reign of terror was being started that, without military intervention, would have caused insurgency and insurrection. It was not an uncommon sentiment in the military at the time. When the U.S. Army made its basic field manual available to the public for the first time in 1935, it included a section on strategies for handling domestic disturbances. The recommendations were unsettling. The guide suggested firing into crowds instead of firing warning shots over their heads, and it included instructions on the use of chemical warfare, artillery, machine guns, mortars, grenades, tanks, and planes against American citizens. Another military manual defined democracy as a government of the masses, results in mobocracy, demagogism, license, agitation, discontent, anarchy. Newspaper editorials and political advocacy groups lashed out, arguing that the U.S. Army had essentially published a how-to guide for waging war on its own people. The military responded, with some justification, that the manuals made no mention of when or under what circumstances these tactics, which were tactics of last resort, should be used in domestic disturbances. The backlash showed that there was still an ample reserve of public support for the broader principles behind the Third Amendment. The outrage grew loud enough that in early 1936, Army Chief of Staff General Malin Craig retracted the manual and ordered it removed from circulation. By 1941, much of the offending language had been either removed or replaced with instructions emphasizing the use of non-lethal force. The military had overstepped, and when it was held to account, it retreated. The instructions were revised to strike a more appropriate tone, one more in line with its proper relationship with the American citizenry. World War II put an end to concerns about communists and anarchists. Protests died down, and with them, the need to send troops to dispel those that got out of hand. But the period wasn't entirely calm. Racial tension mounted in some cities, as black servicemen returned from the war to the same segregation, poverty, and limited opportunity they had experienced before they left. In Los Angeles, clashes between stationed Navy and Marine servicemen and the city's Latinos boiled over into the Zoot Suit Riots of 1943. Riots also broke out in Detroit, Chicago, and Harlem. But only the Detroit riots required federal intervention. The first decade after the war was even quieter, as the economy boomed and veterans settled down with good jobs to start families. But things were about to change. Civil rights victories would inspire revolt in the South, and the counterculture and anti-war protesters were coming. The new era began in Little Rock in 1957. The Supreme Court's 1954 decision in Brown v. Board of Education animated civil rights groups and angered segregationists. When 9 black students attempted to attend classes at Central High School on September 4th, Governor Orville Faubus sent Arkansas National Guard troops to prevent them from entering the building. There had been a number of incidents leading up to Little Rock, in which efforts to integrate public facilities had also been met with violence. Until Little Rock, President Dwight Eisenhower had opposed sending federal troops to force integration, and he initially resisted sending soldiers to Arkansas as well. Instead, he first held a face-to-face meeting with Faubus, thinking he could convince the governor to stand down. Faubus responded by pulling the troops entirely, allowing an angry mob to force the black students to withdraw from class on September 23rd. 2 days later, Eisenhower ordered troops from the 101st Airborne Division to escort the students to school. The soldiers were soon replaced by troops from the Arkansas National Guard, which Eisenhower had federalized. Those units stayed until the end of the school year. Beginning the following year, federal courts supervised the Little Rock school system's compliance with Brown v. Board of Education until 2007. Eisenhower's initial reluctance to send troops to Little Rock is often seen as a stain on his record, perhaps justifiably so. But Eisenhower had ridden alongside MacArthur at the Bonus March. In fact, he had advised MacArthur that there was something unseemly about the military's highest-ranking officer leading a charge against a citizen protest. It's possible that Eisenhower was reluctant to send troops south in 1957 because of what he saw in 1932 and the resulting public backlash. Eisenhower eventually did send troops into Little Rock because, he said, federal law was being flouted with impunity, and he feared that the South could slip into anarchy if something wasn't done. He waited until he felt that sending in troops was his only option. Though an argument could be made that he waited too long, his actions also kept with the protections built into the Insurrection Act. By the 1960s, the civil rights, counterculture, and anti-war movements would be in full swing, leading the government to call repeatedly on the National Guard and occasionally on U.S. troops to keep order in urban areas. Still, the principle of keeping the U.S. military out of law enforcement remained largely intact. Despite the best efforts of too many politicians, the public still tended to recoil at the idea of putting soldiers on city streets, even for a brief time, much less for day-to-day law enforcement. That's the good news. The bad news fills most of the rest of this book. While, as a nation, we have mostly done a good job of keeping the military out of law enforcement, we've done a poor job, to borrow a bit of martial rhetoric, of guarding our flanks. The biggest threat to the symbolic Third Amendment today comes from indirect militarization. Instead of allowing our soldiers to serve as cops, we're turning our cops into soldiers. It's a threat that the founders didn't anticipate, that nearly all politicians support, and that much of the public either seems to support or just hasn't given much attention. No one made a decision to militarize the police in America. The change has come slowly, the result of a generation of politicians and public officials fanning and exploiting public fears by declaring war on abstractions like crime, drug use, and terrorism. The resulting policies have made those war metaphors increasingly real. Chapter 4. The 1960s. From Root Causes to Brute Force. Democracy means that if the doorbell rings in the early hours, it is likely to be the milkman. Attributed to Winston Churchill. Early in the morning of March 25, 1955, narcotics agents in Washington, D.C. arrested Clifford Reed on suspicion of distributing narcotics. Reed told a federal agent that he had purchased 100 capsules of heroin from Arthur Shepard, who was working for a drug dealer named William Miller. The agents recognized that they might be able to parlay a low-level arrest into a much larger bust. Reed agreed to cooperate in a controlled drug buy. And at around 3 a.m., he and a federal agent posing as a buyer gave Shepard $100 in marked bills to buy another 100 heroin capsules. Shepard then took a cab to the home of Miller, with the agents following. But the agent tracking Shepard lost him when he exited the cab and entered Miller's building. Afterward, D.C. City Police stopped the cab that Shepard was in and found the heroin he had just purchased, but the federal agents had failed to observe the actual drug buy. In an attempt to salvage the bust, the federal agents returned to Miller's apartment and knocked on the door. Miller said, "Who's there?" The agents responded, "Police." Miller opened the door and asked what the police wanted, but before they answered, he shut the door in front of them. The police then ripped the chain off the door and entered the apartment. They found the $100 in marked bills, along with around 1,000 heroin capsules. Miller and Bessie Bird, who lived with him, were arrested and convicted on narcotics charges. The police had never obtained a search warrant. Miller appealed his conviction, arguing that the entry into his home was illegal. In 1958, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with him. Justice William Brennan's opinion in Miller v. California was a spirited defense of the Castle Doctrine. The requirement of prior notice of authority and purpose before forcing entry into a home is deeply rooted in our heritage, Brennan wrote. It should not be given grudging application. Regrettably, Miller was effectively the last stand in defense of the home as a place of sanctuary. In the coming years, the court would uphold searches far more egregiously violative than the search performed on Miller's apartment. The first blow came 5 years later, in Kerr v. California. A sergeant with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department had purchased a pound of marijuana from a man named Terrigan in the parking lot of a bowling alley. Terrigan told the sergeant that his connection was Roland Murphy, who at that time was out of prison on bail, pending charges for distributing marijuana. The police put Murphy under surveillance. The next day, in the parking lot of the same bowling alley, they saw Murphy parked behind a new car with a single occupant. From 1,000 feet away, at night, they saw Murphy get out of his car and converse with the driver of the new car. The officers couldn't see if anything exchanged hands between the two men. The police tried to follow the new car, but lost it when the driver made a U-turn. They checked the license plate with the State Department of Motor Vehicles and found that it belonged to George Douglas Kerr. The police claimed that informants had told them in the past that Kerr was known to sell marijuana. The police then went to Kerr's address and found the car in the parking lot of an apartment building. They secured a passkey from the building manager and, without a warrant, simply walked into Kerr's apartment with no knock or announcement. Inside, they found a little over 2 pounds of marijuana. Kerr and his wife were arrested. The Kerr v. California decision was complex. By an 8-to-1 vote, the court concluded that the Fourth Amendment requirement that searches be reasonable applies to the states as well as the federal government, and that evidence obtained in unlawful searches is inadmissible. But the court also found by a 5-to-4 split that the search of Kerr's apartment was lawful. Writing for the majority, Justice Tom Clark found that the police had probable cause to arrest Kerr, to search his home without a warrant, and to enter his home without first knocking and announcing themselves. Clark wrote that there are common law exceptions to the knock and announce rule known as exigent circumstances. One such exception is if police believe that a knock and announcement would result in the suspect destroying evidence. In addition to the officer's belief that Kerr was in possession of narcotics, which could be quickly and easily destroyed, Kerr's furtive conduct in eluding them shortly before the arrest was ground for the belief that he might well have been expecting the police, Clark wrote. Clark cited additional exigent circumstances as well. Police need not announce themselves if doing so would jeopardize their safety, if they are in the midst of an emergency, or if knocking would be a futile gesture, such as during the hot pursuit of a fugitive. Justice Brennan was in the minority in Kerr, and his dissent bristled with indignation. He began with a thorough history of the Castle Doctrine, even quoting James Otis. He made the point that the writs of assistance that helped inspire the American Revolution were less odious, in at least a couple of ways, than the search of George Kerr. Such writs could only be served in daylight hours, and they required a knock and announcement before entry. Brennan also questioned Clark's assumption that the common law provided exceptions to the knock and announce requirement. I have found no English decision which clearly recognizes any exception to the requirement that the police first give notice of their authority and purpose before forcibly entering a home, he wrote. The only exception Brennan found that was possibly in contradiction of the Castle Doctrine's intent was one allowing police to enter unannounced if they believe someone inside is in imminent danger of bodily harm. It is generally accepted today, even by critics of forced entry police raids, that officers should be allowed to enter a building or residence unannounced if the suspect is believed to be armed and likely to resist arrest if given the opportunity. After Kerr v. California, it would soon be accepted by most policymakers that police should